A recent article in The Atlantic last spring spoke of a psychiatrist named William Breitbart who worked with terminally ill patients. Breitbart states that for most of his patients, the most burning questions aren't about death and dying, they're about living. More particularly, they're about life and whether it's meaningful. In Breitbart's words, they are looking for a meaning that can't be destroyed by death. Breitbart claims that while impending death can lead people to conclude their lives are meaningless, it can be a catalyst for them to confront their life and work out meaning in their lives. Breitbart explains that meaning and death are two sides of the same coin. They are, quote, the fundamental problems of the human condition. How should a human being live a finite life, end quote. Breitbart and his colleagues noticed that as they were interviewing patients who were interested in assisted suicide, that their complaint wasn't always that they were in horrible pain. Many of them were in existential pain. Breitbart found that helping them consider the big questions addressed the feeling of hopelessness and lack of meaning that many of them were dealing with in the face of imminent death. Breitbart and his colleagues he brought on board, philosophers, physicians, a monk, began having long conversations with patients about death and the meaning of life. What I suddenly discovered, Breitbart explained, was that the search for meaning, the need to create meaning, the ability to experience meaning, was a basic motivating force of human behavior. Last summer, my dad, who had had numerous revisits from a cancer that first appeared in the 1970s, was given his final diagnosis. Nothing more to be done. He was told to go home and enjoy life, visit with family and friends, take it easy. My dad liked those instructions, but he also decided to read. A voracious reader his whole life, he settled on nonfiction for these last weeks. Really just one topic, death. When asked about it, he would joke that he was studying for finals. My brother, a physician from Lexington, Kentucky, came to visit quite often during those last few weeks. He told me of a film he had watched in medical school about a man who received a terminal diagnosis and was given just a few months to live. The patient described an eerie calm and focus that took over his life. As he talked to people, he found himself truly present. He was totally absorbed in his conversations with people in a way he had never been. Little details of life revealed themselves as miraculous. He spent hours watching little things, such as a bird flying across the sky. A funny thing happened to this patient, however. He was given a subsequent diagnosis, which indicated he might survive. That focus, the man recounted, immediately disappeared, never again to resurface. My father's life seemed to have some of that focus as well. Since he lived just a few houses away from me and I was his main caretaker, I spent a lot of time with him. We took lots of walks, worked on our garden together, sat out on the front porch and chatted with neighbors. Every conversation took on a new meaning. Pulling weeds wasn't just pulling weeds in a garden. It was a meditation on how stubborn life was, how our nature was to focus on survival. A dying bird we encountered on our walk one day haunted us. Everywhere we looked, there was life and death. We were, the both of us, focused and living in the moment. My dad's life, and by virtue of proximity, my life, had taken on new meaning. Yes, it was frightening for him at times, and sad for me, but it was also exhilarating. Watching politics on TV had no meaning for us. Little complications people make for themselves, problems society has always grappled with, always would. So what? My dad lived that way for the last 6 weeks of his life. For the most part, I did too. Then he died. Almost immediately, the mundane noise of the world came back at full volume. Baseball scores, neighborhood gossip, hurricanes, floods, Trump, wildfires, mass shootings, trips to Target where the parking was a nightmare, an expensive speeding ticket, picking a college with my son. That charmed period where none of that mattered left as quickly as it had come. Of course, we can't live our lives as if we only have 6 weeks to live. I'm not going to walk down the aisles of the grocery store with my husband exclaiming that I'd never noticed what a miracle sweet potatoes are. Nevertheless, I miss that focus I had for a few weeks. But it left me puzzled about how to find that meaning, even if I didn't have that sense of urgency. And why didn't I have that sense of urgency? We're all on the Titanic, after all. Our ship is going down. Maybe in a short while, maybe not for a long while. But why can't one keep sight of that feeling? My suspicion is that, as Breitbart claims, it's inextricably bound with death and dying. I'm grateful for the time I lived in that meeting bubble, however. I plan on returning there from time to time. Shortly after my dad died, I remembered his reading to me his favorite sonnet by William Shakespeare. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. We welcome you to a very special River City Chautauqua tonight. Our theme tonight is meaning. We'll have a talk from our regular contributor, Dr. John Simmons, a special talk and some music from Austin singer-songwriter Sam Baker, and talks from Dr. Lisa King and Richard Alwyn Fisher. This is Julie Bennehume, producer and co-host of River City Chautauqua. John Simmons is professor of philosophy at the University of Kansas. He's the author of numerous books and articles in philosophy of mind, epistemology, philosophy of science, and metaphysics. His most recent book, Formal Reasoning, A Guide to Critical Thinking, appeared in August of 2017. He serves as a member of the Institut International de Philosophie and has taught philosophy around the world, including at Peking University in Beijing, at the University of Lisbon, and the Federal University of Bahia in Salvador, Brazil. His current interests include working to understand the effects of technological and social changes on the quality and significance of human lives.
As a child, I collected stamps. I carefully arranged, counted, and cataloged them in an album that sits on my shelf today. I memorized long lists of things. I memorized all the capital cities of all the countries, their GDPs, their populations, their principal exports, and their highest mountains. For me, these things were satisfying and engrossing. I still love jigsaw puzzles, especially the difficult ones with lots of sea and sky, and I can happily lose myself in tasks that other people find boring or pointless. When we say that some practice, imagine a more extreme case like counting the blades of grass on the lawn or organizing a paperclip collection, doesn't count as a worthwhile use of our time, we certainly don't mean that it's morally wrong or unpleasant. If I were a single, childless person with no significant responsibilities, I can imagine choosing to spend my days counting the leaves of grass or perhaps tending to an elaborate tropical fish collection. And such activities probably don't cause significant harms, and I can imagine finding them relaxing and pleasant. I might even regard them as contributing to my well-being in some important way. At a certain point, most of us leave things like stamp collecting and rote memorization behind. We come to feel that they lack a certain kind of value. Even if we can't quite pin down why we feel this way, it seems that other activities, say spending time with one's children, reading a good book, listening to music, or talking to friends, are more worthwhile or meaningful. The judgment that playing the violin is more valuable than, for example, neatly arranging one's paperclip collection, or for that matter, spending hours watching YouTube videos, seems to involve a dimension of value that's neither a matter of one's subjective well-being, how you feel about how things are going for yourself, nor is it straightforwardly a moral matter. A life spent watching YouTube videos might not be morally wrong, and it might be satisfying in some way that I personally don't understand, but nevertheless, it strikes all of us, I think, as not being exactly the most meaningful way to spend a human life. In contemporary philosophy, it's widely thought that judgments of meaning such as these are problematic. Such judgments risk snobbishness, for example. Who are you to say that playing in an amateur symphony or participating in the rituals of your religious community are more meaningful than filling in coloring books or collecting beer mugs? Many contemporary philosophers are likely to say that legitimately favoring one kind of activity over another must reduce to either a moral or prudential matter. What this means is that it must be either morally preferable or more conducive to well-being. There's no special dimension of value, philosophers generally say, that we should call meaningfulness that's distinct from morality or from individual well-being. Now, I don't agree with most of my fellow philosophers on this question. I think that there is a significant question of meaning that's independent of both moral and prudential considerations. Now, there are various ways to understand what meaning might be. According to the philosopher Robert Nozick, quote, "The narrower the limits of a life, the less meaningful it is." On his view, attempts to find meaning in life seek to transcend the limits of an individual life. Nozick's view captures something about our sense of meaning as involving something larger than oneself. So let's think about the meaninglessness of the narrowest kind of life, the life, he says, the life of separated and disparate moments. One way to understand it might be to compare it to the experience of spending your time watching YouTube, clicking from short video to short video. If this was all there was to your life, then it would be a life without the kind of long-term memory or integration that we associate with ordinary human personhood. However, nobody really spends all day watching YouTube. After several hours, the body rebels, and physical and emotional exhaustion ensue. Perhaps, quote, "a life of separated and disparate moments," end quote, is the kind of experience that some simple animals undergo, but even here I doubt it. Some people are convinced that we ought to try to live lives somewhat like this. We often hear enthusiastic praise for the idea of living in the moment. Isn't there something attractive about the carefree spontaneity of a life without attachment to past and future? In response to the suffering that results from difficult memories and unfulfilled hopes, some of us try to adopt a policy of actively forgetting our desires and memories and trying hard to live in the present. No regrets, no anticipation, just enjoyment of the moment. Such a policy is difficult to consistently maintain. We might catch glimpses of states like this in the practice of meditation, but actual meditative practice requires deep commitment. It requires discipline, work, and frankly, an integrated sense of purpose and planning. The dedicated meditator cannot be said to live in the moment. While Buddhism offers a technology for curating one's inner life to some extent and for moderating one's desires and emotional responses, the Buddhist ideal of the annihilated self is not one that you or I can achieve while remaining living, breathing human beings. Buddhist discipline, spiritual practice, and relation to tradition all involve the integration, planning, and affirmation of purpose that's characteristic of an individual life. It's also not possible for us to live a life of disconnected YouTube-style experiences while we remain the kind of beings we are. Thus, in some sense, we can say that Nozick's narrowest kind of life is not possible for us. We're always, even when watching YouTube videos, oriented towards the future and shaped by the past in ways that make us more than separated and disconnected moments of experience. Even if one could stop desiring, if one could stop caring about the future, and even if one could abandon any thought of one's past experiences, projects, preferences, and so on, one might ask what the point of trying to live in the moment would be. As we've seen, to genuinely live in the moment would be to work towards the annihilation of the self. And as such, it wouldn't be possible to say that you or anyone else is successfully living in the moment. So in some sense, the narrowest and most meaningless condition just isn't available to us. It's true that some of us choose to kill ourselves, but the mistake here is the thought that not existing is somehow better than existing, or that simply being alive, even under terrible conditions, is less meaningful than not being. True, we might not wish to continue living in pain, or there might be values for which we kill ourselves, like pride, honor, dignity, and so on. But it is a philosophical mistake to think that by killing oneself, one is responding to the meaninglessness of existence. We can imagine killing ourselves for reasons having to do with dignity and values of various kinds, but these are, in an important sense, life-affirming reasons for killing oneself. Killing oneself because something matters, be it one's dignity, one's commitments, or something else, is an affirmation that such things matter. So nihilistic suicides, suicides motivated by the meaninglessness of life, are in fact a disproof of their own stated credo. The nihilist who kills himself is in fact affirming the distinction between better and worse, between more and less valuable conditions. If there is, as the nihilist supposes, no value or no meaning, then it cannot be better to kill oneself. We are condemned, insofar as our experiences are oriented towards the future, at the very least, to reach beyond the limits of the self. We are, at least on this account, always and inevitably striving for some kind of meaning. This goal of transcending the limits of the individual life that Nozick identifies with the pursuit of meaning puts prudential value, the value of pursuing your own interests and your own concerns, into perspective. Philosophers like Susan Wolf have argued, correctly I think, that there's a difference between honoring one's own concerns, pursuing one's own well-being, and pursuing a meaningful life. We all know, and to some extent admire, people who sacrifice some elements of personal well-being for reasons of love or for something greater than themselves. Some of us have difficult but meaningful lives. Others have comfortable but meaningless lives. We all know, and to some extent do not admire, people who live wealthy, comfortable, harmless, but empty lives. It's not that such people are necessarily living unethical lives. We would not say that they're necessarily doing something immoral, but we might wonder whether they're engaged in a worthwhile or meaningful set of activities. By contrast, we can imagine being, for example, committed to another person, say a disabled spouse, or to a project, say poetry or music, or one might be committed to a set of religious values and practices, and that these commitments might be uncomfortable. They might make you less likely to enjoy high levels of personal satisfaction or pleasure. They might even harm your overall well-being in some important ways. And we can understand why someone might abandon these demanding commitments, why they might divorce a disabled spouse, abandon poetry or, say, philosophy for a lucrative corporate job, or leave a rigorous religious tradition for some easier path. We can understand why someone might do that and yet also recognize that such commitments and practices make one's life more meaningful than it would have been otherwise. We understand that choosing a meaningful life often comes at a price in terms of individual well-being. We also understand that we're not morally obliged to choose a meaningful life. We don't choose meaning because meaningful lives are more pleasant, and we don't choose them because we're morally obliged to live meaningful lives.
So Sam Baker is an American folk musician based in Austin, Texas. Baker's 2013 album, Say Grace, was listed by Rolling Stones as one of the top 10 country music albums of 2013. Baker's compelling story lends a poignancy to his words and music. Among Baker's influences for his songwriting are Ken Kesey, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, and Bob Dylan, and fellow Texans Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt.
Well, hey, everybody. This short piece is on the word meaning, M-E-A-N-I-N-G. And for me, it is a squishy word that I'm not sure I understand. It's so broad and can be so narrow. If I look at the dictionary, it says it's a noun. One, what is intended to be or actually is expressed or indicated, signification, import. Like the three meanings of a word. Number two, as a noun, the end, purpose, or significance of something. What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of this intrusion? Which is quite likely what you're asking yourself right now. What is the meaning of this intrusion? This intrusion to my ears. Number three is linguistics, the non-linguistic cultural correlate, reference or denotation of a linguistic form and expression. B is linguistic content as opposed to expression. See, I don't really understand any of that squishy. Adjective, intentioned, usually used in combination. She's a well-meaning person. Five, full of significance, expression. A meaning look. I don't know what that means. Looks like it's Middle English. So it's old.
I know, forget his face. Of course, I don't. It's like a crystal vase, these broken fingers. Some things don't heal. I can't wake up from a dream when the dream is real. These broken fingers. Forget his eyes, his silhouette. Of course I don't, of course I don't. Forget there are blue eyes, a silhouette. There is a debt, it's a debt I don't. Forget these broken fingers, some things don't heal. Can't wake up from a dream when the dream is real. These broken fingers. I don't forget, I don't forget. princess like a crystal vase. I don't forget there is a debt. But how long ago? It's 16 years every day. Course I know, course I know. Forget his face. Of course I don't. It's etched like a crystal face. These broken fingers, some things don't heal. I can't wake up from a dream when the dream is real. These broken fingers. These broken fingers.
Time ago, I got in the middle of somebody else's war, somebody else's killing spree, and the boy in that song died. It took a while for me to find something that would indicate clarity or context. And back to our original word, meaning. What is the meaning of a life? What is the meaning of that event? What is the meaning of each of our events? Each life, each death. Tom Merton said, love is our true destiny. We do not find the meaning of life by ourselves alone. We find it with another. That words mean more than what is set down on paper. It takes the human voice to infuse them with deeper meaning. Merton, with each other we find meaning. Angelou, with our human voices we use that as the glue, the tendon that connects us. Even a happy life cannot be without a measure of darkness, and the word happy would lose its meaning if it were not balanced by sadness. It is far better. Take things as they come along with patience and equanimity. Carl Jung. Life is without meaning. You bring meaning to it. The meaning of life is whatever you ascribe it to be. Being alive is the meaning. And one of my favorites, Viktor Frankl. For the meaning of life differs from man to man, from day to day, and from hour to hour. What matters, therefore, is not the meaning of life in general, but rather the specific meaning of a person's life at a given moment. Nietzsche said, to live is to suffer, to survive is to find some meaning in the suffering. Michael Jackson said, the meaning of life is contained in every single expression of life. It is present in the infinity of forms and phenomena that exist in all creation, which sounds like Buddha. Way to go, Michael. Good job. I lean, I think, toward Michael's view of the world, that everything has meaning, everything is important, that everything is connected, and everything is sacred. Chagall, who is one of my favorite painters, he says, in our life there is a single color, as on an artist's palette, which provides the meaning of life and art. It is the color of love. I can't really top that for meaning. I think on this morning when I look out and see December trees, the leaves not yet fallen, the juniper and the oak. I hear beautiful sound, multiple messages from people I care about that care about me. And none of it's perfect, but it is perfect in its own glorious way. So meaning to me, I think, is context. Do I fit with good intent, with good motivation to be helpful, to be aware, to be present on this day, to respect that which is sacred, and those around me, they are just as sacred as the oak. Reinhold Niebuhr said, nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. Go in peace, go in kindness, go in love, go in faith, leave the day behind us, day is done. Go in grace. Let us go into the dark, not afraid, not alone. Let us hope by some good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Let us hope by some good pleasure safely to arrive at home.
Lisa King is an assistant professor of rhetoric, writing, and linguistics at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Her interests include cultural rhetorics with an emphasis on contemporary Native American and indigenous rhetorics. She's the co-editor and contributor to the collection Survivance, Sovereignty, and Story, Teaching American Indian Rhetorics. Currently, her work continues to explore the rhetorical practices that surround and produce public representations of indigenous peoples within the United States in museum and performance spaces, while expanding to work with contemporary German and European representations of American Indians and those representations' rhetorical and cultural impact.
First, I want to say thank you to Julie Bennett-Hume for inviting me on the program for River City Chautauqua and to you listeners. I'll begin with a story, because that's the best way I know how. When Julie asked me if I could work with the theme of meaning, I laughed, because if I had to sum up what it is I teach and do, it's dealing in meaning making. And then she told me I had 10 minutes, and that was even funnier. Meaning in 10 minutes. Okay. But in all honesty, it really is what I work with all the time. We all do, to be truthful. Our hours, our days, our lives are clusters of experiences that we struggle to make sense of, and everyone is in the process of crafting their own story. It's a human thing. It's a social thing. Go log on and check your social media feeds. What's your story today? As a professor, as a teacher of rhetoric and writing, I'm immersed in not just the story-building process, but also the questions surrounding how and why and for whom we shape our stories. As it turns out, making sense, making meaning, is far more of a connected process than the idealized individualism of the United States would like to admit. We aren't just telling our stories to ourselves, and even if we compose these stories in our heads without uttering them, we are still at least imagining an audience. We are not just telling, we are shaping, and so meaning-making is deeply rhetorical. A note on rhetoric, and what I mean when I say that. When we talk about rhetoric in the field of study, we mean it in its broadest sense. That includes communication in all its forms, in all communities, and across communities. I know the straight connotation of the term has more to do with deception and manipulation. Just think of the phrase political rhetoric and most people will have nothing positive to say. But I mean it in this much broader sense. I'm interested in speakers and writers and makers. I'm interested in the listeners and readers and users who make up the audiences, because it's never only one audience who hears or reads, it's always more. I'm interested in the contexts. I'm interested in communicative intentions, and I'm interested in the actual communicative effects of those words, because intents don't also always equal effect. I'm interested in how meaning-making happens between people or between communities, or doesn't. I want to know how community building works through positive meaning-making together, and I want to know how meaning-making fails and why. That's rhetoric. For those of us working in cultural rhetorics, it means we're looking at culture, another nebulous term, as a defining factor in rhetorical practices, whether it's how communication defines a community, which in turn shapes its communication to serve its purposes, or how communication happens across community boundaries. We're also interested in history, because cultures don't exist in a vacuum, and we are interested in tracing the lines of power and that power's impact, because we also recognize that meaning-making does not happen on an even playing field. Some voices are privileged, others are suppressed, and it rarely, if ever, happens by accident. Power structures influence meaning-making too, and to ignore that is to ignore a key factor in who gets to speak, who has access to hear, and who sets the terms of discourse. My particular work, has to do with rhetorical practice and how it happens across cultural boundaries in public spaces. Specifically, I work with Native American and Indigenous-owned or oriented museums and cultural centers in order to understand the ways in which Native and Indigenous communities are using museum spaces to tell their own stories. If you look at the history of museums, the Euro-American construct itself, they were constructed alongside the colonization of lands outside of Europe, and frequently their collections and displays were constructed to illustrate the superiority of colonists and the cultural differences and so-called inferiorities of non-Europeans. In the United States, museums became sites for preserving Native cultures and objects as relics of the past, with no future. Native peoples were written out of those stories. So what is beautiful to bear witness to, in all their forms, are the varying ways in which Native communities are creating their own spaces and advocating for themselves and established ones in order to speak back to the stories that erase them and in turn speak their own stories on their own terms. If you ever get to D.C., go see the National Museum of the American Indian. If you ever get over to Lawrence, Kansas, go visit the Haskell Cultural Center and Museum. And if you ever make it up to Mount Pleasant, Michigan, go spend some time with the Saginaw Chippewa Zibuing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways. I promise it's worth your time. Now, that kind of work is a challenge. If rhetorical study teaches us that we need to think about our audience, and cultural rhetorics tells us we need to understand the histories and contexts and power structures and cultures as part of rhetorical practice, then Indigenous rhetorics teaches us something else. It reminds us of relationship and responsibility. And if you have a situation in which you know you are speaking back to a powerful story, and most people are pretty comfortable with that story and don't really want it changed, you have to create a moment in which they want to hear you over the noise of that comfortable, wrong story. You have to tell your story the best way you know how, but you're going to have to invite them in. The audience is your guest and your responsibility. Now, don't get me wrong here. Native peoples don't need your approval to exist, and they don't need to be respectable on your terms or put away their anger and grief. All of that experience has to be told. But if the story of survival and thriving and continued presence is to go beyond community boundaries, the shape of the story has to invite others in. It has to be a story that starts at the heart of the community and then connects with other stories. Relationship. Responsibility. At the same time, it requires that the carriers of other stories be willing to listen. Meaning-making happens together. I can't say that enough. Most of my students take for granted that if you want to communicate well, you need to be able to speak or talk well. That's a commonplace you'll find inside and outside of education. It's a commonplace within the free speech debate as well. A speaker has the right to say whatever they want. It's a free country, right? The emphasis is so often on talking. What my students haven't learned to do yet, or are in the process of learning to do, is to listen. Actively listen. Responsibly listen. Not listen just long enough to come up with a counterargument. I mean listening intently to understand, to see where the speaker is coming from. Relationship. Responsibility. Your story is connected to theirs. Look for it. You don't have to like it, but nothing can be done unless you hear it. Whew, but that tension, though. Meaning-making isn't always a pretty exchange, your story for mine, especially if the story is meant to cut or hurt or erase another person. It shouldn't be a question of domination, of needing to erase other stories in order to keep your own. That's not how meaning-making works, at least not in a way that honors all participants. If your story is the one that has been dominant, the one that always gets told so often that everyone knows it, maybe it's time to listen. It's your responsibility to hear more than your own story. Relationships cannot be built on one person's story. And if your story is the one that's been silenced, the one that doesn't get told, consider when you want to speak it. Your community needs you. And while it may require the right place and the right time, on your own time when you're ready, new relationships cannot be built without you. That's a start. It's not the finish. Here's one more idea that I want to offer. One more concept, a different way of telling the stories. Constellations. Yes, like the stars. Constellations. I'm indebted to Malia Powell, Daisy Levy, Andrea Riley Muckovitz, Marilee Brooks Gillies, Maria Novotny, and Jennifer Fish Ferguson for gifting us this orientation. Unlike the us versus them and the winners versus losers story frames we so often rely on, Constellations gives us a way of thinking about all the other stories we keep as individuals. They harmonize, contradict. They work in tension with each other. They are three-dimensional. They are in motion. We have our internal constellations, and then we ourselves belong to larger clusters of stories and histories and identities, which in turn also hang together in sometimes harmonious and sometimes violently discordant connection. We have some agency in the stories we keep in our constellations. We can shape them. And we are also given stories about ourselves or our communities from the outside, for better or for worse, whether we want them or not. Moreover, thinking of our stories in terms of constellations allows us to consider how we are connected, how multiple perspectives, like different points of observation, allow us new understanding. And since no one person can embody all perspectives, we are reminded again of our obligation to listen and to take those perspectives as seriously as we take our own. In the abstract, I find it beautiful. And in practice, it is hard. The us versus them frame is a strong one. Not everyone chooses responsibly and roots their stories in evidence or fact. Echo chambers abound these days, and by definition, they exclude any stories except their own. Power differentials are a reality and can't be ignored. Like everyone else, I'm wondering about the divisions in this country and what it means to make this country great again when there has never yet been a time when all the stories have been reckoned with. At the same time, I still see hope. If stories are rhetorical, it means that we have choices. And choices mean agency. We can act. We can be active. If we take meaning-making seriously as a practice we do together in a constellation of stories, then the intent is better relationship, and we will own the effects of our stories and words and try again when our stories fail to connect or heal. The most important part of this? The storytelling is ongoing. Yours isn't done. Neither is mine. And I thank you for listening.
This is Scott Easterday for River City Chautauqua. My friend Richard Alwyn Fisher is a transcriber, musician, and producer. He owns a transcription service in New York City. He is half of the musical duo King Canutes with Kier Woods. Richard produces The Love Hangover, a five-city Day After Valentine's Day showcase for which I am the local Kansas City host. We met in poetry class in college.
In the poetry classes I took in college, I always liked the fact that when we reviewed our work, you got to keep all the meanings that your readers found in your poems, even if you hadn't put them in intentionally. In fact, the goal sometimes was to create some higher level of meaning from the description and juxtaposition of common objects and simple scenes. "No ideas but in things," William Carlos Williams was quoted to us. An almost opposite world from my philosophy classes, where language was to be used to construct concise and specific arguments, narrowing in on exact meanings. The tension of opposite meanings started early with me. Years later, when a friend suggested that we call our band the King Canutes, it was a perfect fit. King Canute was an 11th century king of England, about whom two stories are told. In the first, King Canute has a very sycophantic court, and he wants to prove to them that he is merely a mortal compared with the divine will of nature, so he has his throne set up in the surf and commands the waves to halt. They do not, and he is swept away. In the second story, King Canute has an untrammeled ego, and he believes that his powers have no limits. So he has his throne set up in the surf, where he commands the waves to halt, but they do not, and he is swept away. Two stories constructed around the same event, but with opposite meanings, depending on the point the storyteller is trying to make. The shift in meaning brought about by a different perspective is one of the underlying themes explored by The Love Hangover. Founded in Raleigh in the year 2000, The Love Hangover brings musicians together two by two to sing duets about love on the day after Valentine's Day. Against the over-commercialization of the season, it is my Linus-like attempt to bring the focus back to the meaning of love and how we talk about it. By no means restricted to traditional love songs, the artists are encouraged to push the boundaries and explore the various meanings of the concept of love, as well as the lack or loss of it, and the longing for it. Anti-love songs, broken-hearted ballads, and lusty rave-ups are all welcome. The first year I sang with Allison Tussock, we played her arrangement of the Velvet Underground's "I'm Waiting for the Man." She picked up on the subtle difference when Lou Reed says, "I'm waiting for my man," and her version comes across as more of a bubbly but hip 50s love song. While not completely changing the meaning of the song, there is enough of a shift simply by the presentation that as we sang, someone asked a friend of ours, "They know what the song is about, right?" Some philosophers theorize that the mechanics of language put our impressionistic thoughts into more meaningful form. It has further been posited that dance or improvisational music might be a more pure expression of our ideas and feelings. I, however, feel that a quick-moving interactive conversation may be the most direct channel for conveying your thoughts in a communicative way. It is less measured and therefore less filtered than writing, but the meaning is more clearly elucidated than through dance or music. And the back and forth of the conversation helps you to formulate and adapt your thoughts to counterarguments and offers feedback as to whether your intended meaning is coming across or not. I spend a great portion of my life in the world of conversation. In addition to my own conversations, I run a transcription company. Our job is to render the audio spoken word into a text format for a broad range of clients, each of whom have their own priorities and end uses for these transcripts. It is, of course, paramount that a speaker's meaning be clear as it's written, which can be trickier than it sounds. Think of how the meaning can get lost in a text message, devoid of all the guiding nonverbal cues such as inflection and pauses. Our crew of transcriptionists recently had a discussion about the treatment of the word yeah. Previously, we have been converting all positive assertions such as yeah, yep, and uh-huh to yes. But we decided that yeah actually could have a distinctly different meaning, that of a soft yes, a yes but, as in, did you like that movie? Yeah, it was good. Or even the complete opposite meaning, as in, he's doing a good job, isn't he? Yeah, great job. Those are instances where the meaning of what you're saying can get lost by the format in which you're saying it. It's also interesting to think about a psychoanalytic conversation in which you are interactively rehashing the stories you tell yourself about your life in hopes that someone can help you discover meanings that are hidden in your subconscious. Currently in 2017, there are several trends in public discourse centered around meaning. One is the calling out of microaggressions. Coined in the 1970s, the concept of microaggressions is the small but cumulative negative actions or speech directed toward any marginalized group. Although seen by some as trivial or even a compliment, such as, "You're pretty for a dark-skinned girl," the meaning is not just that you're pretty, but that you belong to a group, dark-skinned girls, that isn't normally thought of as pretty. Some of these statements or actions can be the result of ignorance or innocent misunderstanding. Others are the product of a learned and internal bias that doesn't reach the conscious level. In these cases, the negative meanings conveyed might actually surprise the speaker or actor, but they are there. Still others are malicious but dismissed as throwaways and can even generate a strange feedback loop of offense that someone might take offense at such tiny, innocuous things. In this sense, they move closer to the second trend in meaning, the sending out of dog whistles. A dog whistle is the act of conveying a hidden meaning, either to a group that shares your belief without alerting those who might not, or to a group you are trying to threaten with deniability. Wearing certain clothes, earrings, a pin with an icon or a mascot, the way you knot a handkerchief, these all carry meanings to the members of your group or club in a way that is completely lost on those who aren't. In other instances, we've seen public figures imply things, even threats, with just enough ambiguity or supposed humor that when the meanings of these statements are called out, it's met with faux indignation or counter-accusations of hypersensitivity. Some may be claiming we're in a post-truth era, but we are in no way post-meaning. But then an overactive mind can hammer meaning into anything. The ticking of a clock suddenly means time is slipping away. There are plenty of non-linguistic symbols and icons that have an agreed-upon meaning. Consider the meaning of a flag. Imagine yourself traveling for miles and hours under the cover of darkness, uncertain as to whether you are still behind enemy lines. Between the trees, you start to catch a glimpse of a fluttering sign, and when the wind and the light catch it just right, usually by the colors alone, you can tell if you should stay hidden, stick to the woods, or if you are home. Viktor Frankl, in his book Man's Search for Meaning, says, "Those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how," and that life is never made unbearable by circumstances, but only by lack of meaning and purpose. Frankl used his experiences as a prisoner in several concentration camps to form the basis of logotherapy, a meaning-based existential psychology. This is the power of meaning as a counter to meaninglessness, that meaning and purpose give you strength to endure the difficulties of life. There are many places to find a meaning like this, a meaning that can guide you and ease your struggle with life, maybe even make your life seem like not that much of a struggle at all. Love, service, and duty, living not just for yourself, but with another, can give your life meaning. Some writers, mystics, or poets feel their work is that meaning, that purpose. And even if they cannot connect as directly with another single individual, their calling is to convey their understanding of experience, their ability to process, explain, and codify, fictionalize, and distill the world for others gives their lives meaning. But even if you can't put it into some form for other people, I have a theory, or perhaps something between a theory and a metaphor, that we are all of us, humans, animals, all sentient beings, we are all the sensory organs of the universe as it tries to understand itself. So each experience we have feeds back into the collective unconscious and adds data to the supermind of the universe working on this problem, this project of existence. So the meaning of your life doesn't even have to be to interpret or even understand your life, but to continue to experience it, to continue to soak in what you're seeing, what you're doing, how you're coping, how you're feeling. And all of that will help the universe to understand itself. And as I prepare this for you, I think, you know, this is just a story. It isn't true. And yet, it conveys a meaning about these several things that I believe are true. It talks about how we're all connected, which is true. It talks about our unceasing quest to understand things, which is true. It talks about purpose and how you can find it and how creating meaning can change the way you live your life. And maybe that's the best part of a story, is that it gives meaning to a series of complicated truths.
This concludes tonight's program. I would like to give a special thanks to our guests, Lisa King, John Simmons, Richard Alwyn Fisher, Scott Tishner, Betsy Ellis, Clark Wyatt, and Sam Baker, who will return to Kansas City on February 17th to play at the International Folk Alliance at Crown Center. Thanks to Bill Claus, our engineer, and to KKFI. Join us next month when our theme will be rivers. This is Julie Bennett-Hume for River City Chautauqua, wishing you a good evening.